Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in DeWitt, Michigan, earned a BA in finance from Michigan State University, and an MBA in finance from the University of Chicago. From 2010 to 2024, he was the president of Bank of America, Michigan. And since 2025, he's been the CEO and founder of Blue Lake Ideas, which helps companies and leaders tame chaos, unlock clarity, and drive sustainable results. The author of Overloaded, Recapturing Leadership Capacity with the Power of End. His name, Matt Elliott. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything is Possible. We're with Matt Elliott. Since 2025, he's been the CEO and founder of Blue Lake Ideas. Matt, welcome. An honor to have you.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
You've hosted shows at WJR, so welcome back.
It's nice to be here.
So let's go back, DeWitt, Michigan. Your mom and your dad, your childhood, please.
Yeah. So I grew up in Lansing at first, and then we moved to DeWitt, when I started fifth grade in DeWitt. Ironically, we moved to the same road where my dad grew up as well. And I started school in DeWitt at the same school that he did when he was a kindergartner. A little bit of a different environment, obviously. So I grew up in DeWitt. My parents were really interesting people in a lot of ways. My dad was a preacher's kid. And so he was the oldest of four boys. I think he moved seven times as a child and had to repeat a few grades. So he graduated from high school at the age of 20, believe it or not, but still ended up going on getting a bachelor's and a master's. Met my mom in Battle Creek. My mom is from Southwest Michigan. She grew up really in poverty in a town called Lacey. My mom worked on the Kalamazoo Gazette. And, through the years, my mom and my dad raised both my brother, who's younger than I, by about 4 years, while my dad worked two jobs, while my mom went to school full-time and worked full-time. So I grew up in a house of really hardworking people. And in my view, like having two jobs, for example, was sort of a normal thing. And you mentioned that I was president of Bank of America. That was actually my second job at B of A. My first job was always running commercial banking, either here in the state or around the Midwest.
And, what's the biggest thing you learned from mom, Matt, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
I think from my mom, it was this idea of ambition, this idea of continuing to do better. My mom was a very ambitious person, and compared to where she started, from where she landed, she really made a lot of progress in her life from every perspective, not just like financially, but also as a in terms of her growth. For my dad, it was really about service. My dad started in firefighting. That was what he was doing when my mom met. He was a firefighter, and then he went on to become a teacher. But he taught firefighting. He was a teacher in the Lansing Public Schools for 30 years, and he was always a member of a fire department, like literally until the day he died. So for my dad, it was all about service.
Well, in the banking business, you put out fires every day. So
that's for sure.
How was it you got into the banking sector in 1990?
Yeah. When I was coming out of undergrad, really the options that were available to you were, working in corporate finance, so working in the finance department of a large company, or working in banking or financial services. And what really attracted to me about banking was this idea of being able to work with lots of different kinds of companies, to be able to learn those businesses and to be able to serve them and support them. And that was really interesting for me. And it held my interest for 35 years. And I really loved that experience.
Talk to us about that 35-year chapter.
Yeah. Well, it started literally on June 18th of 1990 in Skokie, Illinois. That's when the training program started at NBD Bank for us in Illinois. But
that was the end of the L.
Yes, that's a really good point. The Skokie Swift.
Yes.
Is exactly right. You know that as a Chicagoan.
Yes.
And as one of the only Southsiders I've ever met who's a Cubs fan, by the way.
The Pope isn't perfect. We have to pray for the man.
He is a Sox fan, for those of you who don't know on the radio. You know, that the arc of that really was, you know, you start learning your craft. You start by learning credit. And the things that I always enjoyed the most about the beginnings of my career was supporting business owners and companies and how they solved the problem, how they would, you know, figure out the puzzle that is trying to run a business day to day, and how we and I could help do that. And then later, as I became more of a leader, you know, at some point you transition from player to coach, if you will, you know. Then I really fell in love with the art and the science of management and leadership. And so those are the two things that I still try to carry through in my consulting practice, is try to help these leaders deliver and win for the people that they care about and then they are responsible for, because that was the part of the job that I enjoyed the most in banking.
A lot of people that know you well say, he's not a banker. He's a world-class businessman who just happens to be a world-class banker. You dealt with entrepreneurs for decades. Tell us about entrepreneurs.
Entrepreneurs are fascinating people. it's humbling to hear what you just said. But I always have thought of myself as a business partner who happened to be a banker. Now I'm a partner as an advisor. The thing about entrepreneurs that is the most fascinating to me is their conception of risk. That a lot of people who are naturally risk averse would not take the kinds of risks that entrepreneurs take. And I think in some cases they take those risks because they just evaluate risk differently. Some of them are risk loving, and sometimes they're very calculated in the way that they take risk. But I think that entrepreneurs also have a lot of self-confidence and they learn fast. I think the most successful entrepreneurs that I've worked with are the ones who have learned and adapted very quickly, especially now that the world is moving more quickly than ever. And now that I'm an entrepreneur of sorts, I'm trying to learn and adapt quickly myself. So I'm trying to take lessons from the people that I've worked with over 35 years and adapt them in my own new life.
Entrepreneurs believe that success is a journey, not a destination.
Mm-hmm. It sure is. And, you know, I think the entrepreneurs who are, and the ones who are in it the longest and the ones who do it the best, are the ones who are more focused on that journey rather than the outcome. You know, the owners that I really loved to work with were the ones who weren't necessarily focused on getting paid. They were the ones that were always focused on trying to further the mission of whatever they thought about, you know. And in a lot of cases, it was furthering the mission so they could support all of the families that they employed. Maybe it was about the product or service that they delivered. Sometimes it was a little of all of that. but I think, like in anything, Jack, if you're mission-driven, you know, if you're about a greater purpose, then that greater purpose is something that's more sustaining than a paycheck or the next quarter or the very narrow goal that's outside of yourself.
Customer care, not just in the banking business, every business. I've always believed that the tellers at a bank are the directors of first impressions. Mm-hmm. They're the book cover.
It's a great point. I think that there's this concept I learned in undergrad, believe it or not, of the boundary of the organization. And in other words, those are the people or the places where someone who's outside the organization first interacts with that organization. Those people or those places, it's like, say, an app, those are the boundary. And it's absolutely critical that those on the boundary embrace and embody and understand the how and the why of the company. You know, or the organization, however you want to define it. The thing that I used to tell a lot of the folks that I worked with, and when you work at a place as big as Bank of America, for example, most of the people aren't on the boundary of the organization. That's just the way the organization is designed. But I would always try to make a point that behind every file, behind every name on a piece of paper or on a computer screen was a person with a story, and that what we were handling was their financial life. This wasn't, you know, we weren't selling, you know, paper towels. We were taking care of someone's financial life, which is very important in the lives of anyone, you know? And so that job to me was more important and is more important than, you know, some others, because you're handling something so sensitive to a real person.
We're talking to Matt Elliott. When we come back, we're going to ask him the most important thing he learned, the biggest thing he learned during that 35-year banking career. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasulo. We're with Matt Elliott. From 1990 to 2024, he held various leadership positions within the banking community. And from 2010 to 24, he was president, Bank of America, Michigan. 35-year career banking. What's the biggest thing you learned, Mr. Elliott?
You know, this may sound weird coming from someone who is a numbers person, but the most important thing is always people. It's always about the people. Which doesn't mean that you don't have to deliver numbers. Actually, delivering numbers gives you the right to lead the people. But ultimately, you're driving outcomes for people. And the thing that will drive the outcomes for you the best are making sure that you lead and take care of the people. You know, the machines and the technology, they're all there to enable that. And I think that the leaders who I know who are the most effective are the ones who are able to balance that tension between the numbers and the people, because you have to do both. It's not one or the other, but ultimately it's got to be about the people.
If you were speaking to 100 bank leaders in their 30s, what would the message be?
Well, I'd start with that. And I have spoken to hundreds of bank leaders before in the past. And I think that, you know, the other thing that is critical, and I talk to leaders about this all the time, is that so many things about banking and so many things about leadership aren't about solving one pole of a problem or another. It's about balancing tension. So in banking, for example, it's always the tension between, say, loan growth and loan quality, delivering the numbers and the people. Most of my clients, it was always about how do I execute today and plan and invest for the future? Help me figure that one out, Matt, for example, through a cycle, you know, through an economic downturn. Those were always the things that were, on the one hand, the most difficult, but the things that also drove the most value.
You have great love for Michigan State University.
Sure do.
And a while ago, God sent you a terrific president, Kevin Guskowitz, mm-hmm. and then he left to go to Clemson. And 2 months later, he comes back.
Yeah.
Tell us about President Guskowitz.
Well, first of all, President Guskowitz, Kevin, is a wonderful person. And he's the kind of leader that you can tell cares about the people. Kevin grew up in Western Pennsylvania. He's from Latrobe, by the way, not far from where Arlo Palmer grew up. And I think, you know, even though he had spent the majority of his career in North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which is an amazing institution, as soon as he and Amy got to Michigan State and they became, you know, sort of reacquainted, if you will, with the Midwest, they number one, connected with that. They also, number two, connected with the ethos of MSU, everything from the land-grant mission, the scope of the place, which is very significant. It's huge. As well as just what it's like to be a Spartan. And I think those are three of the core things that were the intangibles that really made it hard for him to say, yeah, I'm ready to go back. And so lots of people rallied around Kevin to number one, let him know that we care about you. Number two, we're going to support you. And number three, your work's not done here. And I think ultimately that idea of the work not being done here is what brought him back.
All right. Lots of people rallied around him.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the leaders of the rally was Coach Tom Izzo.
For sure. You know, there is no greater ambassador for MSU than Coach Izzo. He cares about the place more deeply than anyone I know. And that's saying a lot because everyone I know cares about MSU, including myself. but he's willing to put his money and his time and his political and energetic capital where his mouth is. And I think that made a really big difference in coalescing a group of people to say, wait a minute, Kevin, your work's not done. We're going to make this better for you, and we need you. And I think those things are that all made a difference for him, and he had to make his final decision.
As you've watched Tom Izzo for 30-plus years,
yeah.
What's the biggest thing he's taught you, Matt?
You know, and I'm putting this in my book. He does something that is very, very rare. He invites hard coaching. So a lot of times you'll see on the sideline Coach Izzo, you know, really getting energetic, let's say, with a player who needs to be corrected. But what you don't know is that at the beginning of every year, he asks the player to write out their goals on a 3x5 card. And then he says, okay, here's what you need to do. Here's the gap between where you are and where you want to be. And this is what I think it's going to take for you to close that gap. Do I have your permission to coach you there? And so when he's getting on a player about something or other, what he's doing is closing a gap. And that's also when you see players who have been there for a long time and they understand what the program is like and they've been through a few cycles of that. They'll put their arm around coach and say, "Coach, I got it." You know, it's a player-led team in that way. And I think he just does a wonderful job of building a player-led team by inviting the coaching.
Speaking of coaching, recently President Gascoigne started the Green and White Council.
Mm-hmm.
And he named co-chairs Sanjay Gupta and a kid named Matt Elliott.
Yeah.
Tall cotton.
That's for sure.
Do you get good seats at the football and basketball games?
I still have my same seats. That's okay.
Okay. What's the Green and White Council?
The Green and White Council is a group of business leaders who we assembled, Sanjay and I, along with Kevin, to better connect the business community along with the university. And the idea was to advise the university on some ideas to drive better outcomes for students and also better economic development outcomes for the state of Michigan. So how do we better connect, for example, the research and the facilities at MSU with the problems and the opportunities that the business community has here in the state of Michigan and around the world? And then how do we connect students with with great jobs here in Michigan and train them for jobs of the future? So the council assembled and we came up with three threads of work that the university, led by faculty and amazing staff, are now driving forward. One's around AI, another is around better career outcomes for students, and a third is what we call Spartan Catalyst, which is better connecting research and thinking with real-world problems in corporates. And we are making tremendous progress. I mean, the uptake by faculty at MSU, who are just amazing, has been really humbling. And I'll be actually up at MSU all day tomorrow talking about how I can help continue to enable the work.
Some students in America embrace AI.
Mm-hmm.
Others boo it. Talk to the ones that boo it.
Well, I'll just use this title. So the working title of the course that we are going to offer to every MSU student starting in the fall is called AI Essentials. And I think the word essential is critical there, meaning that this is essential. I mean, this is not optional. But what we want to do is make sure that we train everyone on how to use AI ethically, how to use it responsibly, so that you're not outsourcing your thinking, you're using it as a thinking partner. And that's the real trick, is how do we use, and again, it's about people, Jack, so how do we use this tool of AI and the agentic AI to help enable and enhance and accelerate our productivity as people? And that's the goal of the work, not only of that Essentials course, but also of all of the other AI-enabled coursework that's being generated and created right now at MSU.
We're talking to Matt Elliott, co-chair of the Green and White Council. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula. We're with Matt Elliott. From 1990 to 2024, you worked for Bank of America. You were the president of Michigan. You were revered. And then you walk away. One, when you came home and told Ann and the kids, "I'm quitting," what did she say? And why are you quitting?
Yeah. Number one, my
wife. Ann says, "Honey, I love you, but you ain't home for lunch. That's for sure." Okay.
That's after, you know, decades of not being home at dinner. You know, I had really a burnout experience, Jack. So to the answer to the question about how Ann responded, she was grateful and she was relieved. What happened to me was that I had gotten a point in my career where this is what I write about and work with leaders on now, is that the load of all the responsibility had caught up with me over a series of years, to the point where I woke up one morning in June of 2024 and I thought for sure I was having a heart attack. Now, as it turns out, after the trip to the ER, I learned that I didn't have a heart attack. I ended up having what they called a stress reaction, so that's code for panic attack. But what that taught me was that I needed to take a break. And that I needed to realize that I can do anything, but I can't do everything. And so that's when I called a timeout and to really to kind of create some space to figure out what do I want to do next in a way that's sustainable. And so that's what led me to make the decision to try something else. And really what I've done now is take that experience and learn about it, study it, and bring that to the leaders and the groups that I speak to and that I advise now. Because what I have found is that more and more people than ever are in that overloaded place just like I was.
All right. Since January of 2025, you've been the founder and CEO of Blue Lake Ideas. If you want to learn more, www.BlueLakeIdeas.com. What does Blue Lake Ideas do?
Well, fundamentally, what we do is we help leaders retain the capacity to deliver and win in what we call the always-on AI era. So here's the facts. As I said earlier when we were talking, the very best leaders, the very best companies are the ones that find the and. They execute today and they plan for the future. They take care of the people and they deliver the numbers. I call that the power of and. But accessing the power of and is difficult. It takes energy, it takes space. And when we're in an overloaded state, like we are increasingly in this world of accelerating change, it's almost impossible to find the and. And so what we need to do is create a system that allows us to recapture that capacity. Capacity now is the number one leadership challenge in our always-on AI era. If we have enough capacity to do the work and harness the and, then we can be successful. So I've created with the help of some partners who are psychologists by training and corporate trainers by vocation, a system and a process to be able to do that. It's a very simple three-step process you can use by yourself and also in a team setting, which we do in our workshops. And really it's about, number one, pausing and reflecting and finding clarity around what matters most. The second is finding that and. What are those critical things that we need to balance, those tensions we need to balance to be successful? And then thirdly, testing and learning our way into achieving that state, not trying to change everything all at once and overloading ourselves. So if you do that and you make that a practice, then what we find is that you're able to stay focused on what matters most, retain your capacity, and deliver and win.
All right, let's go deeper. You said a three-part process. First, pause and reflect.
Yeah. By creating the pause, what that does is that interrupts our thinking so that we can bring our full brains online. What usually happens, Jack, is when we're overloaded, we're really only thinking with our intuition. That's sort of your brainstem. That's your autonomic nervous system. If we want to access the power of and, we need our full brain. We need our prefrontal cortex, as they say. The pause brings all of our brain back online. So now we're able to harness the and we're able to think about things like, all right, what and who matters most? What do I really control here? And is there a different way for me to think about this issue or problem or challenge? That's the first step.
Yesterday, I had lunch with a priest, and he was talking about the first hour of your day mm-hmm. and the last hour. Turn off, no TV, no computer, no iPhone, just pause, reflect. Be quiet.
Yes. This wisdom goes all the way back to people like Seneca and the Stoics, who believed that every day was like a circle and that every day began with some examination and ended with some examination about what do we want to do and where did we end. This is not, you know, there are very few new ideas under the sun. This is a different way to package that concept, but also to hard code it into your process, into your organizational process or into your personal process.
Okay. Second phase, name the tensions that are important to balance.
That's right. We call that finding the and. And so what we have to think about are what are the key tensions. So for example, I'm working with a client right now who has a wonderful culture. They're very collegial, but because they're so collegial, sometimes they have a hard time calling each other out when they need to be corrected. So the and that we're working with there are, you know, finding this tension between empathy and accountability, enforcing a standard, but yet being empathetic to our colleague. That's tough. But if you do that well, then you end up perpetuating this high-performing culture. That's an example.
Phase three, do new things to bring end to life.
That's right. But do it in a way that's bounded and has some discipline to it. We called it test and learn. Most change efforts fail, Jack, because they ask too much of too many people too fast. This is different. This is about taking a small thing, testing it, and then implementing it, and then doing that over and over and over again so that change becomes a habit, not an event.
We're talking to Matt Elliott. He's got a new book coming out in a couple of months. Overloaded, Recapturing Leadership Capacity with the Power of End. When we come back, we're going to ask him about why we should read that book and buy that book. And I'm Jack Crisilla, and this is Anything is Possible on 760 WJR.
You've been listening to your inspirational fireside chat, Anything is Possible, for nearly 20 years.
This is Anything is Possible, and I'm Jack Crisilla.
But what has Jack been up to lately? Search at AIP Speaker Series and find out. Jack has interviewed thousands of historical voices, some of whom have offered him their philosophy of life, like Tom Izzo.
And Tom writes, "Work hard, persistence always wins out, discipline is the highest form of love. Stay humble."
The great Ernie Harwell.
"My aim is to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with God."
And the voices of our generation.
"I am reassured continuously that His unfathomable love and mercy are the greatest gifts of my life and my constant source of strength, reassurance, and guidance. His Holiness, Pope Francis."
At AIP Speakers Series is the YouTube channel where all of these jewels can be heard, including some of Anything is Possible's greatest guests.
And we're with Mitch Albom.
The Little Liar is really a book about truth and lies and the price we pay when we lie.
This is Anything is Possible, and with Tom Watson.
"My father loved to play with the pros at the club, developed a very quick friendship with Stan and played some golf with him. And then he would ask me to play golf with him and Stan."
Our guest this week was born with a rare disorder characterized by the absence of arms and legs. His name, Nick Vujicic.
Something that every human being actually deals with, Jack. It's the choice of continuing to believe or giving up.
And recordings of the AIP Speaker Series events at St. John's Resort. Go to YouTube and search at AIP Speaker Series. It's free. And remember,
anything is possible.
Spohom. I'm Jack Crisilla. This is Anything is Possible. We're talking to Matt Elliott. If you want to learn more, www.bluelakeideas.com. Matt's got a new book coming out in a couple of months, Overloaded, Recapturing Leadership Capacity with the Power of End. What do you hope we take from this book?
My biggest goal with the book, Jack, is to give people a tool to help them not just survive, but thrive in a world of accelerating change. I see and I talk to a lot of leaders who are struggling with not just, you know, how do I advance my mission of the organization a year or 3 or 5 years from now, but how do I get through the week? And that's because a lot of folks they're out of capacity. They are overloaded. And so number one is just starting with the fact that we're all overloaded to one degree or another because we live in a world that our nervous systems weren't built to handle. But that doesn't mean we have to throw up our hands. We can do something about that. And that's what the tool that's embedded in this, which we call the AND intelligence practice, is all about. So I go through and I talk about the neuroscience of it, but mainly it's about the practice of it. So I want people to have a tool. I want them to feel empowered and I want them to feel hopeful as we lean into this world that is going to change faster than ever.
The greatest motivational speaker of our lifetime was Zig Ziglar.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. The first book he ever wrote, See You at the Top. 40 times in the book, he says, you can get everything in life you want if you will just help other people get what they want. That won't work in today's world.
Oh, I disagree. I think it's always about taking care of other people. The thing of it is that when you feel threatened or when we're trying just to get from one end of the day to the other, and I felt that way for years, it becomes very difficult to reach outside yourself. So when you're encapsulated inside yourself, in my view, it's largely because you are overloaded. And this idea that we're trying to accomplish is helping everybody retain or regain their capacity, recapture that capacity, so then they can deliver and win for three things. Number one, so that they can keep the promises that they make to themselves. So they can, secondly, that they can fulfill the obligations they have to the people that they lead and serve. And then thirdly, that they can maintain presence for the people that they love. And if you do those three things, you know, then I think you're delivering and winning.
I've heard this statement, in today's world, you must keep learning while you're earning. That's a Zig Ziglar.
That's a good one. Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, organizations that tend to get caught up in what I call the binary trap, and people who are caught in the binary trap where everything's good, bad, right, wrong, left, right, those are the folks who need to be right. And what I'm talking about is more like focusing on getting it right. As my wife used to said, and she said to me when I was in my hospital room saying, listen, Matt, do you want to be happy or do you need to be right? And I really wanted to be happy. And so ultimately that meant I needed to do some learning. And I think organizations are the same way. If organizations continue to learn and experiment and create space for that, then they're going to be successful. The ones who think, you know, I'm too busy to learn, I just got to get through today, are the ones who are going to have a hard time getting to tomorrow.
Okay, I quote you. AI is coming for your tasks, not necessarily your job.
Yeah, that's true. I've learned that. And I've learned that by talking to a lot of people who are AI practitioners, and using AI myself. But ultimately, you know, AI is there to be a tool to enable our meaning people and humanity's progress. There is one thing that makes AI different from other tools is that it's agentic, so it can make some decisions for itself. Which means that a lot of us humans are tempted to sort of outsource our thinking to AI. That's very dangerous for lots of different reasons, but the biggest one is that means we stop learning. So ultimately, we want to use AI to accelerate our learning so that we can offload certain tasks and we can work on the higher order tasks and maybe even get to places and do things we never thought possible.
All right, you said something about being right. I quote you again, getting it right versus being right.
Yeah.
If there's a listener that says, I always have to be right.
Yeah.
That's how I live my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say?
A lot of people feel that way. I've heard that many times, by the way, I need to be right to feel happy. Well, you're not. I guess the answer to me always is you're not going to be happy very often, because that means that the narrow slice of reality that needs to show up for you to be both happy and right is narrower than just being happy. And the clients that I used to work with and the leaders I used to work with were less hung up on the world showing up in a specific way, i.e. being right, and more hung up on let's just continue to make progress. Let's continue to be happy and heading in the right direction. Those are the ones ultimately that I believe are the most successful, because they're learning, they're moving forward, they're advancing, they're evolving.
In today's world, the only constant is change.
Mm-hmm.
Some people embrace the change. Others, ostrich, put the head in the sand. What do you say to the people that fear change?
Well, change can be scary, but I think ultimately part of happiness is embracing the fact that life is always about change. You know, the Buddhists would say the world's impermanent, and it is. There's nothing permanent in the physical world. Everything's always changing. What's different about change that we all have to understand now, Jack, is that change is accelerating. It's not just that change is continuing, it's just change is getting faster and faster and faster. And that's one of the reasons why, and that threatens our capacity. And that's, again, one of these reasons why we need to recapture that capacity so that we can be successful.
All right. A listener says, mea culpa, I'm guilty of all of these things, and I am overloaded.
Yeah.
Matt, what specifically should I do?
Well, there are some basic things. You know, number one, we talked about it at the beginning. You said you interviewed a priest the other day. It was a long tradition of starting a day with a moment of reflection, a moment of pause. And I think that starting your day with a moment of pause and to be clear on what you can want to focus on that day is really a great way to start, as well as a moment of pause and reflection at the end of the day. Organizationally and in business, the best companies that I've worked with historically have always had a moment of pause in their routine, be it a daily meeting, a weekly meeting, something that requires everybody to stop and take stock of the big picture. Because remember, we can do anything, not everything. And I think embracing that concept, not everything, is really important.
Mother Teresa used to tell her nuns, you pray an hour, the first hour of each day. If and when you don't have time to pray an hour, on those days, pray 2 hours. A lot of people believe Michigan's house is on fire.
Yeah, and there are in many ways it is. And if you look at the data, and I'm a data-driven guy, when you look at things like educational attainment, if you look at things like income growth, if you look at things like economic development, we have fallen dramatically. Let's take educational attainment. We have fallen dramatically in the last 10 years from, say, you know, middle of the pack, maybe a little bit better, to 41st in the nation in, say, third grade reading. Okay. That is not a recipe for success. So these are things that a lot of the state's populace isn't really aware of. We all believe that we're doing okay when in fact we're not. And so if we want to make a change, the first thing we have to do is embrace what Jim Collins would call the brutal facts. And the brutal facts are, in many ways, our house is on fire.
You and Ann had Jack, a great name, okay, who's 28 years old.
Yes.
25 years ago, God brought you an angel.
Yes.
Named Meg.
That's right.
Tell us about Meg.
So we named Jack and Meg before we knew about the white stripes. Little joke for your listeners. But Meg, we found out when she was about four, she was diagnosed with autism. And this ended up being sort of our first, and my first experience with the power of and. you know, we did everything we could to help her early on. But I remember in third grade, we had a meeting with her counselors, and they said, they kind of pulled us aside at the end of the meeting and said, Meg still holds a pencil like she's holding like a stick. And you know, when we see kids who are doing that at third grade, that's kind of a tell. And we typically don't see kids like that succeeding later in life. We don't see them being independent. And that was a real wake-up call for us. And so we thought to ourselves, how can we find the and? Meg's always going to have autism. And how can we figure out a way to help her be independent and have some control and agency over her life? So we formed what we called Team Meg. And we really threw a lot of interventions and wrapped a lot of interventions around Meg. For example, for, I don't know, 5-6 years, she would meet every Sunday with a math tutor. And she would, and we would, the tutor would pre-teach her that week's math lesson so that she knew she could keep up. And, you know, our daughter is an incredible worker. She is an incredible bulldog. And so you fast forward from where that was in third grade till now, she's 25. Meg is a college graduate. She is a near fluent Japanese speaker. She has lived in Japan for a cumulative total of about 6 months on her own. And so she can live independently, as it turns out. And yet she also still has autism. We're amazed by Meg, and we're also excited for what her future holds.
And she's blessed to have you as a dad and Anne as a mom.
Anne in particular, but yes.
Keep up the great, great work. Please join us next week. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week because
with God, anything is possible.
Spoken.